Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the topic, Why Christianity is Becoming Increasingly Unbelievable and Why It Must Undergo a Dramatic Reformation in Order to Survive and Be Relevant. My guest, Bishop John Shelby Spong. He is a renowned American bishop of the Episcopal Church, previously from Newark until he retired in 2000. And as a liberal theologian, he has represented an alternative voice for Christians and religious persons, and for decades has challenged the status quo in today's religious institutions. As a lifelong biblical scholar, Bishop Spong consistently challenges the hard-held Christian myths such as, well, the virgin birth, miracle stories, the doctrine of atonement, and Jesus as a universal Savior, the ascension, and other theological structures that continue to define most of Christianity. The bishop has been a visiting lecturer at over 500 universities around the world, including Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge. He holds degrees from the University of North Carolina and Virginia Theological Seminary, and has also studied biblical scholarship at Yale, Harvard, Union Theological, Edinburgh, Oxford, and has received many honorary doctoral degrees. And he's published over a dozen books, the most recent being Unbelievable, Why Neither Ancient Creeds Nor the Reformation Can Produce a Living Faith Today. The bishop's weekly column can be found on his site, johnshelbyspong.com. That's S-P-O-N-G. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
During the time since you published your book, I believe that was around 20 years ago, Why Christianity Must Change or Die, I believe that we're still witnessing many sectors of American Christianity, particularly the evangelical wings, that have an enormous amount of influence in our body politic. Think of Ronald Reagan, think of Jimmy Carter, and even Trump and Bush and Obama. They've all been right there as decision makers. That concerns me. But they also have been living with these profound medieval myths. That's my opinion. I can be very, you know, I've looked at this as much as I can, and I'm thinking, wow, they do not fit into a postmodern culture and increasingly contradict the historical and biological and scientific record. Yep. It's as if our knowledge base of the past and our own history as a species continues to advance Christianity as well as some of the other religions as well, and that continues to recede further into a dark age. And I hope that you don't think that's just being excessive, but among them are the beliefs in the theistic and anthropomorphic God, a cosmic war between God and Satan, and the Immaculate Conception of Mary, and the mythology of a primordial fall of humankind and original sin, and Jesus' ascension into the heavens shortly after the resurrection, and even the power of prayer as a means for self-cherishing egos to receive whatever they want. And there are still many who believe in the creationist myth. Hard as that might be, they believe that the cosmos was created in 7 days, just a mere 6,000 years ago. Yep. And the last myth always fascinated me because on a clear night sky, you can see the star V762, which is over 16,000 light years away, which means by simple grammar school physics, it has taken this star's light 16,000 years to travel through space to reach my eyes. So the evidence to debunk the biblical chronology is right above our heads on a very clear night. And nevertheless, these beliefs have been transformed in Christianity as creeds and the fundamental defining characteristics that are believed to be essential for calling oneself a Christian. But before we tackle some of these topics, and I apologize for my extended introduction, but once I give you that question, the forum is yours, so take your time. I won't be interrupting you, except to ask you a few additional questions. And then you take a look at yourself and others, a liberal Christian leader who has been deconstructing the Christian mythologies with extraordinary scholarship over the years. and what you personally believe a vital Christianity should be that would be relevant to our postmodern times and the human challenges we face. For example, your concept of God that is at the ground of the religions of Bene Israel, which is at odds with the supernatural deity that resides somewhere distant and out of our reach. I think that's enough of a palette for you to paint on. The form is yours.
Thank you, sir. Good to be with you tonight, Gary. First of all, let me tell you that I think the evangelical ascendancy is in decline. And I think it's because they've made their bed with Trump, and he doesn't affirm any of their beliefs, but they think that he will act in their favor. But I think they're in a decline. I don't worry about them, because people have to have something that they can cling to that's irrational, and they're not going to set the wave of the future. The fact is that every generation that goes by, the science approach is so dramatically different that it moves them further and further out. The church is dying. Anybody can look at the mainline churches and say that every one of them, Roman Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Lutheran, they're all in a statistical decline. The category of nothing is ranked equal with the category of evangelical and Catholic in religious polls that people in the millennial generation are taking. They say they're not anything. They'd rather not be anything to be identified in one of those things. And that's just the millennials. The generation after millennials are even less affected because they cannot put their mind together with this with what they hear in church. Now, that's been going on for a long time, and it's not going to be a little while till it disappears. It's going to be a long while, but its power is broken. I quoted my daughter, who's got a PhD in physics from Stanford University, who said to me, "Daddy, the questions the church keeps answering, we don't even ask anymore." That was a rather profound statement, I thought, and it rocked me a little bit. Let's look at the church for a moment. Look at some of the things we say we believe. We believe in a God above the sky. Well, we haven't been able to think about a God above the sky since Copernicus. But it's taken a long time for Copernicus to become one who people trust because it's not according to people's primary desires. Well, if God is not above the skies, where is he? Well, you mentioned some astronomical facts. Let me throw a couple more. We live in a galaxy called the Milky Way. Our galaxy is made up of billions of stars. Our sun is one of them. It takes light traveling at the approximate speed of 186,000 miles per second, 100,000 years to go from one end of our galaxy to the other. That's what's above the sky. And that's just a little bit above. There in the universe beyond our galaxy, there's something like 400 billion or trillion other galaxies that are visible. That's a huge expanse of space. And where is heaven? Where is hell? Heaven and hell are simply an attempt to control human behavior on this earth. They have nothing to do with life after death. They've been used over the centuries to control human behavior on this earth. And we've done a pretty good job with selling them on that because it's worked pretty well. But that's not, nobody's scared of hell today. Nobody's eager to get the blessings of heaven. They just don't know what those things mean. They're empty words that we use heaven as an adjective to talk about things that are heavenly. And that means everything from a lemon meringue pie to a new dress to good sex. It's just not a very big word anymore. We use hell as a mild cuss word. It has no meaning. We say it's hot as hell today. We say it's cold as hell today. We mean the same thing. So what does it mean? Those are the things that we've got to look at. And the Christian story is based on the idea that Jesus, human life was created perfect. Human life then fell into sin in the Adam and Eve story. And then God decided to come rescue human life. And God decided the only way to rescue it was to let human life kill the rescuer. And none of that makes sense to me. It doesn't make original sin is a dead concept. Now, does Christianity have a future? I think it does. That's what makes me unusual, I suspect. I think it's got a future that is way beyond what goes on in church today. And I think we're in need of a reformation of enormous proportions to get back to our original purpose and meaning.
Wasn't it Voltaire who said, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is?
No. Well, I don't know who it was, but there's some truth in that. But I think that we've got to change that, because I don't think the task of the church is to make people secure. I think the task of the church is to make them embrace their insecurity and be proud of it. We'll never be secure if we keep our minds open to the realities that are behind us. And it's a wonderful thing to embrace your insecurity. That's alive. That makes you feel good about yourself. But that's not what people think.
When you look at Jeff Sessions, our Attorney General, and he prides himself in the mantra of he is a true Christian, as have others, Dick Cheney, for example, and George Bush, Senior and Junior, and the Clintons. And then look what they do just today.
That's where it breaks down.
Jeff Sessions today was talking about criminalizing, and meaning prisons, taking people to jail who are too poor. And hence, we have criminalized being poor. Now, how does that reconcile even with the construct of a Jesus that they're supposed to believe in?
It doesn't reconcile at all. And that's a trap the church is in. It doesn't reconcile for Jeff Sessions. And he's a pretty insecure guy sitting in an insecure position. And there's not much we can do to help Jeff, because he just doesn't understand. But that's a fact that we need to be aware of. Why is it that I, as a struggling Christian over my lifetime, had to fight the church at every level to get across human virtues like trusting and believing in the humanity and goodness of every human being? And in the race fight, the church is on the side of the racist. In the female fight, the church is on the side of the male chauvinist. In the homosexual fight, the church is on the side of the straight white male. Everywhere you go to fight for humanity, you find the church opposing you. Now, but there's one other thing that people don't always see. The church that's opposing also produces people that are leading the charge. We produce Martin Luther King. The civil rights movement was run by the black church, and it was a marvelous thing. We produced Nelson Mandela. He was an active Methodist. He turned South Africa around. It's always a minority. It's never the majority. It's always a minority. And after a while, the majority begins to see what the minority was about, and they get on their side.
When I think of the arguments that are being put forth, legitimate arguments by many of the feminists and have been, what I'm frequently finding that it's the morality issue of misogyny, but it's always been the argument that it's man who is the oppressor. And I'm thinking, why not hear from the spiritual feminists, those who come from different religious backgrounds or spiritual backgrounds, who are not looking to blame, who demonize the other, but rather looking to heal? Shouldn't that be part of the message of Christianity? Stop all of this nonsense with the rituals that are meaningless, and actually do something. And let me add one more statement onto that. In 2007, I began a documentary. I'd been working on it for about a year about poverty. And I decided to drive across America and just speak with normal, regular people. And I intentionally stayed away from Appalachia, my home state, home area, because of absolute dark poverty. And stay away from some of the inner city. I wanted to see the new poverty. People who had been living normal lives, had a roof over their head, and had a quality of life, who now were struggling because this was being taken away.
Yep.
And there was one particular neighborhood that just absolutely struck out. I remember standing in the street, and I set up the camera. Every other house was for sale because they were being foreclosed on, or had been foreclosed on. So I began to go into neighborhoods that were predominantly just middle-class neighborhoods. And I asked people, I said, how many homes, how many people have you know? Oh, you know, probably 80% of the people we know in the neighborhood are gone. I said, how long have you known these people? Well, we've been here 35, 40 years. So these are long-time people you've grown up with, your kids have gone to school with. Yep. When you saw that they were struggling, or word got out that someone was struggling, did anyone in the neighborhood go to those people, go to your neighbor across the street, and say, friend, what can I do to help you? Maybe I can give you some food. Maybe I can store some of the things. Maybe we can go up and down the street and try to get, you know, someone else to help. And I said, and the person looked down at that point and said, no. I remember when the man was moving out with his family, and I looked out the window and I saw all the people that we were friends, and I wasn't his friend in that moment. I turned away. I was so embarrassed. And I said, well, you are aware that 7 million people have had their homes repossessed, and that means 28 million Americans lost their home, and I don't know of anyone, any movement, any march, any demonstration, any church group, any synagogue, any mosque, anyone in the religious community said, let's go to Washington, create a national strike, close down America if we have to, until they put a moratorium and stop home foreclosures. Now, if just the Christian churches had done that, Obama would have stopped the home foreclosures. It didn't happen. What does that tell you about how deep the spiritual value is revealed versus merely the moral inclination to align oneself with the moniker of being a Christian?
Yeah. Well, that's difficult. What you're talking about is a systemic thing. When an industry closes and the whole town dies and people feel helpless, they don't feel they can do anything to help. They sort of retreat within themselves and hope for the best. And it's just tragic. The tragedy is that we have in this country a vast percentage of the wealth is owned by a minimum percentage of the people. Something like 99% of the wealth is owned by the top 1% of the people. And there's something wrong about that. But you start talking about that, and people say, you're a communist. Well, that's kind of funny. But they said I was a communist when I supported race relations. They said I was a communist when I supported women. So I don't pay much attention to that. But there are some leaders that come out. I remember in Ohio, in Youngstown, Ohio, during the around 2008 when the collapse took place, the bishops and the councils of churches got together and decided that they would try to buy Youngstown Steel and run it as a family business. It failed, but it was a try, and it was enormously hopeful that people saw the church standing on their side. In the Episcopal Church, we had a bishop in the 1960s named John Hines, and he walked the streets of Harlem and Detroit and Watts and other places in Europe and interviewed the people and found out they didn't give a hoot about the church's doctrine and dogma. And he instituted a program called the General Convention Special Program to invest in the inner city. And boy, was that controversial. But he did it. And it finally bore some fruit, but it also was a minimum effort against a larger problem. We do have some individuals who come along and try to address those problems, but they have nothing to do it with. They have no power of government. The power of government is in the hands of the wealthy. The Senate, almost everybody in the Senate is a millionaire. There are very few people that are not millionaires. If they weren't millionaires when they weren't, they became millionaires while they were there. And they lose their sensitivity. I don't know what you do about that, but what happens usually is that the social situation will grind down until it gets big enough to cause people to do something about it. That's what happened in 1932 when we elected Franklin Roosevelt. And people thought he was a communist. He saved capitalism. We were on the verge of a revolution in that period of time, and he saved capitalism by shoring it up, by taking some money away from the rich and spreading it out among the poor so that they had a fighting chance. It was a delightful time, but we've gone back in the same thing. We had the crash in 2008, and Obama ran that crash as well as any politician has ever done, but had no support from Congress, and it was a minimal effort, but he got the country through it. And then, because we had not had any increase in salaries for vast majorities of working class Americans, we elected Trump in 2016 because he kept talking about how angry America was. He's going to make it bright again like it was back in the 1950s and 60s. You see, I don't think we were so bright in the 50s and 60s. We weren't bright if we were women. We weren't bright if we were black. We weren't bright if we were gay. We've come a long way, and I support that, and I'm delighted about coming that way. But I think we're in a critical time right now, a backlash time, and it's going to be, I don't know, we'll make it through 4 years.
I don't think that the Democratic Party has any kind of intelligent leadership. Educated, yes.
Well, I'd say that's highly true for both parties at this point. I don't see any real national leadership at all.
No.
And I'm sorry about that, but sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. I promise you there is a leader out there somewhere waiting to be discovered, and we'll have a chance in 2018 to vote. We'll have a chance in 2020 to vote for the presidency, and we'll have a chance in 2024. We will do it in one of those elections because it can't get any worse.
Well, just imagine then, and I would agree with that. I think you're right on point, that if people within the Democratic Party, be at least those that still understand ethics, start to realize how both the Republicans long ago and the Democrats in the last since Clinton have been compromised by their leadership who've aligned with the major financial interests.
They'll
tell you one thing, and then they do just the opposite. And Obama was just as guilty as anyone else on that.
Well, look at the way the politicians have responded to the national gun law. The polls show that Americans favor background checks and keeping guns out of the hands of children by something like 80-85%, but we don't get any bills through Congress. I'll be really pleased. The best bill they got through Florida the other day was to sell guns to 18 to 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds instead of 18-year-olds. That's a step forward, but that's not nearly a major step. And we had another killing at another high school just today.
I would like you to focus for a moment on something. What do you think would happen if those who are more independent-minded start to realize that the answer to their jobs, their communities, their rust belts, which the media is not covering. It's only covering the 24,000 plus points on Wall Street in the equity market and the bond market and the artificial unemployment figures of 4.3% when it's actually 28% because there's 102 million Americans who once worked full-time who now don't, and they don't tell us real figures. They don't tell us anything real. But what do you think might happen if the younger millennials, the older individuals, began to simply say, you had a chance to change in 40 years the standards to bring jobs here, keep them here, get people a living wage, not just a suffering wage, and you didn't do it. And that and the Clintons betrayed the unions, the union leaders betrayed their own members, and as a result, those union people, many of them were blue dog Democrats, they voted for Trump because they were so angry at the lies and deception.
Well, we'll read the tea leaves and then see what happened. I think that we've really got to recover our basic value system, and that includes the Christian faith to me. And it means that you do not treat your neighbor that way. But we're just so far removed from that idea. We think Christianity has something to do with going to church. It really doesn't. It's got to do with, it has to do with seeing God in your neighbor, and that's the primary thing. Bible is so full of stories like that. The parable of the judgment in Matthew's gospel has God addressing the good people. He didn't once say, how much did you go to church, how much did you pledge, were you known to the treasurer? None of those things came up. He said, how many times did you see God in the face of the poor? And that's the whole basis of judgment.
I'd like
but
to ask you some short
that's a minority.
I'd like to ask you some short answer questions on this.
Okay.
As it has evolved today, does that same Christian belief see sacredness in a Palestinian kid in a ghetto, or see a Yemen kid starving to death, or a Haitian kid dying of cholera? Does Christianity acknowledge anything sacred in the seven different wars that the presidents are in right now and how that has impacted the people in those communities, because most of the people who've gotten us into these wars say God told them.
Yeah. Well, God gets blamed for an awful lot of things. I would say that a minority of Christians do see that, but it's not enough to make a difference. But we do see it, and we don't let that vision die. When's it going to happen that some action will be taken? I don't know. I wish I did.
You make reference to the great modern German theologian, Paul Tillich.
Yes.
Who taught at the University of Chicago, and for those of us growing up reading his work, it was very influential. And I recall that Tillich once said that for every productive system of thought, three questions must be addressed. First, what is the problem? For example, what is our disease or disorientation? How are we not doing what we should? Or why are we doing what we shouldn't be doing, and what might individuals do, or is society do, or religion do, or a species do that could live in harmony? And second, he said, what is our vision? If Christianity were to be healthy, vital religion that it's claimed to be, what might it appear like? And then finally, how do we move from the first question to the second? Meaning, in other words, what is the medicine that is non-toxic and curative? So addressing Tillich's first question, what is the primary disease in Christianity today? And what is it about Christianity that is preventing its followers from fully embracing life more fully and becoming more constructive players in the human drama with compassion and kindness and caring and a sense of social justice?
Well, Tillich is my favorite theologian. I studied him in great detail. And the first thing that Tillich does is to say there's a difference between God as a being, that's a theistic God, and God as being itself. That is, if God is being itself, everyone that has being is in God. We start there. And that's a good place to start. Secondly, he says that life is good, not evil, and because life is rooted in God. And thirdly, he says that... Let me go back to those other two. I think that what has got to happen is that we see God in the way we see life. I can't tell you who God is or what God is, but I can tell you what my experience of God would be. And my experience of God is never what God is. That's where we make a crucial mistake. There is something evil about human life. I think the fact is that every creature that lives is oriented to his own safety. He's survival oriented, and when you're survival oriented, and somebody gets in the way of your survival, you can act in a very destructive manner. But we've got to see survival as something that we want to overcome, and I think that's what it is. We human beings aren't but about 3 or 4 million years old. We don't know what the future is going to be. It may not be human. You know, in 165 million years ago, the dinosaurs were the top thing in creation, and they were going along with no enemies, and all of a sudden, the whole world turned upside down, and a little mammal began to evolve in Kenya or somewhere in that part of Africa, and that became the start of the mammals and ultimately of the human race. Now, I don't know what's going to be the future, but I know that the more developed a human being is, the more he has transcendence, the more he has a sense of that he is eternal, the more he has a sense of the rightness of life and love and being. And I think we ought to dig in at that point and say, if you want to be a Christian, you've got to learn to love wastefully, you've got to learn to live fully, and you've got to learn to be who you are. That's a positive message. I don't see that message coming out of Christianity. Forrest Church, who was a friend of mine before he died, was at All Saints Unitarian Church in New York. And he said on one occasion, God is not the name of God. God is the name by which we determine who God is, and that's a great big difference. And I don't want to confuse those two. Forrest Church is also the author of a book called God and Other Famous Liberals, which I thought was a wonderful title to a book.
The dinosaurs lived 68 million years ago, and they just discovered today one was still alive living in the White House. That's unfortunate.
Well, that's a bit pejorative.
Yeah.
It's tough to be an American today and a thinking American, because every day there's something new embarrassing.
Yeah.
And people aren't embarrassed yet. They just are not embarrassed yet. There's a 30-35% minority that supports Donald Trump no matter what he does.
Well, one of the pivotal pillars of all Christian belief today is the atonement theology, that says that Jesus died for our sins. Now, which of course keeps people in a constant juvenile state of servitude and victimization and helplessness. And this is one of the crucial defining creeds in evangelical Christianity. However, throughout history, mystics and even ordinary people have had profound experiences of oneness. The sense of separation between ourselves and whatever transpires as divine or sacred is abolished. And yet these experiences are regarded as suspicious or illusionary, unless Jesus is the medium of a person's encounter with something sacred or mysterious. So when and how did this atonement theology take hold of Christianity? And
It only started in the 4th century. It's not in the Bible.
How did it corrupt the Christian message?
Christianity became a Gentile movement by the 4th century. And we had a part of our creed said Jesus is Messiah. They didn't know how to translate Messiah into the Gentile world. And so they changed it to Kurios, the word for Lord, and said Jesus is Lord. And that opened up all sorts of doors. Then you have to begin to understand why it was that Jesus is Lord and he died. And they played that atonement game. It kept the situation holy. But what it does is that it kept the situation whole. What it does is to make guilt the primary motive of the Christian faith. I'm guilty. I have to pray, Lord, have mercy upon me. I can't imagine a God I've got to ask to have mercy on me. You ask mercy of a judge who's going to hang you. You ask mercy of a parent who's going to beat you. You don't ask mercy of God. That just violates everything I know about God. God is a source of life. We worship God by living. God is a source of love. We worship God by loving. God is the ground of being. We worship God by daring to be all that we can be. And when we take that lens and look at Jesus through that lens, Jesus looks very different. And that's one of the things that's a major section of my book. And I really wanted to make sure that people have an alternative to think about. We are not sinful people. Original sin has got to go. It's just terrible, a terrible waste of human nature.
I well said. I certainly appreciate that insight. Easter is upon us.
Yes.
In another 10 days, and throughout the world, all of Christendom will be honoring the death and resurrection of Jesus. And basically, Christianity could not exist without the resurrection.
We misunderstood the resurrection totally. There are two words that we've confused. One is resuscitation, and the other is resurrection. It's interesting to look at Paul, who was the first Christian writer in the Bible, and Paul never uses anything but a passive sense. Jesus never rises in Paul. Jesus is called into a new set of being, and he's resurrected into God. He's not resurrected back into the life of this world. And when you get to Mark, the first gospel written, risen Jesus never appears. He just isn't there. And you get to Matthew, and the first hint of Jesus being resuscitated instead of resurrected makes its appearance, but it's a minority appearance. He appears to the women. But when Matthew tells the story of Jesus appearing to the disciples on the mount, in a mountain in Galilee, he says that Jesus came down from heaven to be on that mountain, and only the disciples had to climb up that mountain. But they had a vision. They didn't see a physical Jesus. But then when you get to Luke makes Jesus' resurrection very physical. He eats, he drinks, he walks, he talks, he interprets Scripture. And from that moment on, it becomes very difficult to separate resurrection from resuscitation. Lazarus was a story of resuscitation. He came back in his old skin, presumably had to die again. Paul says that Jesus, having died, is you're never going to die again. Death will have no more dominion over him. He had a sense of being raised into God that had nothing to do with physical appearances, but it had to do with truth. This something happened to the disciples. They saw the risen Lord raised in glory. And we ought to, excuse my voice, it's a little weak this evening. We ought to have a way to put that insight back into the Christian gospel. I think I'm convinced that Jesus was resurrected. He was raised into God. And out of God, he opened a vision to others to see. But it's not physical. It's never been physical. And it's time we begin to talk about that. But you say that, and my goodness, you can get all sorts of strange looks and brickbats and everything else. But, you know, I think it's time for us to take those brickbats and turn them around and say what we really believe. I've tried to do that in this book.
Good for you. I just wish people would read Paul's epistles and understand what the real meaning of many of these gospels were. And just take a few moments, if you would, please, for people who may not be aware of this, but a lot of both ultra-Orthodox believers in any religion believe in the absolute sanctity of every word, that every word came either from God or was given to God's son or messenger, and therefore is inviolate. And anyone who challenged that throughout history was dealt with as a heretic. So let's look at a few facts just to get them clear, what we're talking about. The Bible was not written by one or two men talking with God. It was written over 1,000 years. If you look at how long Moses, by no one knows how many men, but they were all men. Women were excluded. And why? And why was all the punishment towards women and not towards men? Because they were never considered equal. What was going on in some man's mind that he felt so threatened by femininity that he had to castigate that out? He purged his own demons of insecurity, fear, and incompleteness by manifesting this demon woman. Don't sin for that.
Starts with Eve and kept going.
Yeah, and yet that is something that a very insecure man written. Also, what about all the spiritual text in the Gnostic text that were excluded? And then look at the fact that nothing was written about Jesus in the near future after his death, and therefore no one was alive who had met with Jesus, who wrote about him, and there's that great impasse. So imagine today you told someone, write about something that happened, but you never interviewed anyone. There's no record of it. Maybe some oral records, but create something so we have something to believe in that is something that keeps our society together. It must be a combination of fear-based superstition and absolutism. And then along comes Constantine and Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea. Take us on a little journey, if you would, please, to let us know what we're really talking about when we talk about any religion, but we're talking about Christianity today. And the books that are written, what part is honest, what part is allegorical, what part is historical, so that people have a chance of understanding.
I take any part of the Bible literally. I take all of the Bible seriously. And I think if you do that, you begin to be open. The Bible, you're right, it was written over 1,000 years by a great company of people. And it didn't become the Word of God until about the 4th century. And that's when it turns at the Council of Nicaea. But anybody who believes that the Bible is the literal Word of God is just not educated. I don't care who he is. You don't want to say, slaves, obey your masters, this is the Word of the Lord. You don't want to say, I forbid a man to strike a woman unless it's the Word of God. You just don't do things like that. You don't say, husbands, obey your wives, obey your husbands as unto the Lord, if you aren't serious about the Bible. But we've got to get over those facts. I think the Bible is a wonderful book, but I'd never take it literally. I don't think Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. I think the Sermon on the Mount was developed to give a reinterpretation of the Ten Commandments. And the words of Jesus, the first gospel was written about 72. That's 42 years after Jesus died. I don't know anybody that remembers what somebody said 42 years ago. And John wasn't written until the turn of the century, so he's about 70 years. We've got just a real ignorance in this biblical study. But I think that's the church's fault. We've got that Bible. We ought to be teaching that Bible. When I was in Richmond, I taught a Bible class every Sunday morning, and I went through all the stuff that you go through, and we tossed it out, and somebody said, well, what's left? Well, there wasn't anything left, if it's literal. But the Bible can give you insight into human nature that's pretty deep and profound, and we treasured that, and we worked on it. Nobody with an education is going to believe in the seven-day creation. Indeed, there are two creation stories. In the first one, the man and woman are created together on the sixth day, and in the other one, the man's created on the first day, and the woman is created a little bit later because the man was lonely. Just in the first two chapters of Genesis, you've got a huge corruption of the text. And we've known that for years. It's time we stop pretending. And part of the reason is the church. You know, you go to a Catholic church or an Episcopal church, maybe even a Lutheran church, and when the gospel is read, the book is held up high, and they walk down in the congregation, and it's an invitation to worship the Bible. And it doesn't bear worship. It's just not that good. And I say that with a deep devotion to the Bible. Every book I've written has been about the Bible. And I spend my life studying, and I recommend it, but not the way it's taught. The way it's taught is worse than nothing. Bob Funk in the Jesus Seminar used to say, I hope my children never go to Sunday school because they'll just get a distorted view of the Bible, and we can do some talking about the Bible without that distortion at a later stage in life.
Well, when you consider Rollo May as one example, and there are dozens of others who used some of the interpretations, biblical interpretations, but in a more humanistic way for today's minds.
That's
then
right.
They had a lot of people who became interested in being more spiritual, but without all the religious connotation. For example, the younger generation increasingly wants nothing to do with institutional Christianity, and millennials and now a younger generation are leaving not only Christianity in droves, but organized religion in general, and they rely upon creeds that seem out of touch with the demands of our time and the strict laws and codified many centuries ago, and consequently they are rapidly turning atheist or agnostic, and Christianity no longer speaks to their needs and the deepest concerns such as climate change, destruction of the environment.
The way it's interpreted, Christianity is just not that. And I think Christianity does have a message for this world, but it's not the message that we get in church every Sunday. But we've got some individuals who are challenging the church on a regular basis, and what will happen is that they'll raise up a little group of people in their church who will become articulate and begin not to be burdened by the guilt of the meeting. And I like to see a church have a heretics club, have a book study group where people can gather in the church and study the book, and as any book is okay, and find truth in it that they can relate to their spiritual lives.
What are your thoughts about the doctrine of universalism when we look at the human family sharing this single sphere in the cosmos that you talked about and sharing the same DNA from distant ancestors before the advent of theistic religions, and the fact that Christianity only compromises about 32% of the world population, and that 32% is divided into numerous Christian churches and sects, many of which differ greatly from each other and are antagonistic to each other, and yet Christianity claims that one must be a Christian, believing in Jesus as the Christ, in order to be saved. So as long as such a law is acknowledged, humanity will always remain divided, in my opinion. And are there teachings within the Bible or in the Gospels or in heterodox texts that would open Christianity up to recognize that it is one among many faiths, neither superior nor inferior to the others. Is there a place for a universal fellowship between faiths and Christianity?
Well, the last chapter of my book, I use it as a call to universalism. And I mean by that we are to love every person just as they are without one plea. And it doesn't matter whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. That's your basic, and that's the basic calling. And that's what it means to love another. You've got to love yourself. And those things go together. And I don't know that the Bible has ever meant to put that sort of burden on people, but that's what the church is used for. I go to church every Sunday, I might say, and I love going to church. And my church, about 10% of the time, gives me a sense that they understand the issues are bigger than they are. 10% is enough to keep me going. And I treasure it. And I'm constantly in the dialogue. I'm constantly talking to people periodically. I teach a class in the church. And what amazes me is that when I teach and say these things, I get the biggest crowd of the year. And people ought to recognize that. They're not running away from church. You're losing more people by playing to the weakest member than you are by being bold and daring and saying, look, we got a world out there that we've got to speak to. But you would lose some. I did when I was a rector. And I just made up for it with others more quickly and survived because of it. But that's the way life is.
When you look at the Christian right, particularly evangelical fundamentalists who support Donald Trump, and before that they supported others, Bush and Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan, the most extremist side of the Republican Party and are perfectly fine with our nation's imperialist and militarist agenda and Islamophobia and anti-gay power beliefs. What are the earlier precedents in Christian history or theology that have contributed to finding Jesus' life and message aligned with violence and racism and even white privilege or superiority?
There's not much, but they've made it into a cult. I just think that's got to change. And I think that is changing. Donald Trump does not appeal to the Orthodox evangelical. And he has numerous affairs, and he speaks in a language that wants to kill people who are offering drugs to folks, and speaks about how important war is, wants to bomb North Korea. I think if we go through enough Donald Trump, Christianity is going to look terrible. And I think it's got to find its basis in history and present a different point of view. That's why I think evangelical religion is not as strong as it used to be. And that's true in the South. I come out of the South. What evangelical religions turn toward are these mega churches that are feel-good churches, and they're designed to make you feel good. And that's a step forward. It doesn't sound like a big step forward, but it's a step forward from making you feel bad and saying you're going to hell and you got to repent and that sort of thing. But they're not going to last either. It takes a massive personality to carry those things, and not everybody. They have a problem when they look for a successor to their present pastor.
Mm-hmm. Mega churches remind me of how difficult it is to become aligned with a spiritual message in a mega church is no different than how difficult it is to become aligned with healthy choices in a Whole Foods market.
But that's a separate issue.
Now, I want to give you a little story, and I'd like for you to give me your input on it. I had a group of scientists when I was a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, and I was doing an experiment. And this was not a nutrition experiment or anti-aging experiment. Rather, it was something that I had grown up with in West Virginia. My mother was a sensitive, and as you know, a sensitive in the South is someone who can engage in healing and seeing. And they use a simple technique that they have to exchange energy. You hold someone's hand, and you don't even have to talk. And a lot of doctors in the South did what they call a Christian healing. where they just wouldn't administer medicine. They would sit and hold the person's hand, and most people are not aware of this. In any case, here I was at the Institute, and I wanted to try an experiment. And here I had all my friends, most of whom were atheists and were agnostics. Most were highly educated, doctors and lawyers and judges. And what I did was this. I took a group of rats. These rats I got from someone over at Sloan Kettering, and they generally live 22 days. And I brought in people. You've heard of Catherine Coleman and Olga Wuerl and Harry Edwards. I had 50 people who claimed that they had the ability to heal. Well, it's one thing healing someone in a mega church when you're smacking them on the head and suddenly they go into what looks like a fake seizure. And then, you know, I never see those same people going into a hospital to go through the children's ward to heal the people there. It's rather hypocritical. But be that as it may, you're not going to be able to play that game on rats, and especially rats you can't actually handle. You could be right there with them, but there's a monitor. I was with them. But at the end of this study, of the 50 people who tried, six were able to actually reverse the cancer. So you have to, okay, that could happen, but not if you go by standards of doing it six times. They had 100% success six out of six times. Now, there was Rabbi Abraham Wiseman from Brooklyn. There was a professor, chairman of the Department of Nursing, Dolores Krieger. And from that therapeutic touch that is taught to all nurses came. Dr. Thomas Kruth, Dr. Morton Jacobs. So these individuals were able to heal. And what no one could understand is they couldn't understand how that happened. And I said, well, that's the difference between linear reductionistic mathematical model for healing and yet looking at universal energy. And if you want to find the power to believe in something beyond your own ego, watch that and see that something happened that you can't explain, but it's a phenomenon that happened. And I replicated that on several occasions. And then you start to realize how powerful is a mother's touch to her child's bruise or injury. How powerful is the love of another person? And the very things that I believe allow Christianity to have legitimacy as what it is possible are those who understand that is in the spiritual energy that can be shared and make it a better world. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I think that's true. We've always known that there were things called spontaneous remissions we don't understand. And we have some doctors that get involved in those, and they're very wonderful. I've had a couple of experiences in my life where I was with a person dying with cancer and saw them on a regular basis over the last year of their lives. And we touched something very beautiful, very beautiful. Once you get over the fact that you're dying, you can share your life intimately with a person because there's nobody, no fear to stand by. Nobody's going to judge you. And they really were beautiful. I think they help people die gracious deaths. But I don't know. I can't explain it. But I think it's real. And I think that loving touch. We had some studies that indicated that if a person had loved ones at home, they didn't stay in the hospital as long. So people that were lonely, that had nobody to love them at home, they liked to stay in the hospital a little longer. We know that people talk to flowers, and their flowers grow better. I don't know what causes that to happen. But it might be just breathing on them. Your carbon dioxide causes the thing to grow. I don't know. But I know that the world has a spiritual center to it, and I want to be part of that spiritual center, and I want to find access to that spiritual center. And I think Christianity has also got to find a new spiritual center. I think we can do it, and I hope we can. I wrote that book to give people hope that there would be a Christianity very different from the one we have parodied for the last couple of thousand years, but a Christianity that still has integrity and power.
Well, I certainly appreciate all the good work you have done. Bishop John Shelby Spong, thank you very much for being with us today. And he is the author of Unbelievable, Why Neither Ancient Creeds Nor the Reformation Can Produce a Living Faith Today. His website is johnshelbyspong, SPONG.com. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Let me hear the worshipers! Where's all of my praise?
God. You all know how we do it. Take it up. Give praise. It's you.